Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. We're here to empower people, live a longer and healthier and happier life. We're also here to encourage people to look at the issues that they can make a difference with in our lives. What can we do to help other people, to make it a better world? We're going to deal with all that today. Also, we've added something new to the program, and we're beginning it today. We have a voicemail line where people can call in at any time and ask a question. And we're going to take about two or three of those today. And you can take down the number and you can call. That number is 862-800-6805. Again, 862-800-6805. That'll follow health and nutrition. Also today, we're going to have a short segment from the news project about will the new Congress end up with its staying with Saudi Arabia and its war in Yemen, or will it change? A legitimate one. We also have a guest in the second part of our program today, and that guest is going to talk on some important issues. That's Sam Husseini. And we're going to talk about looking at everything that we're doing that we shouldn't be doing when it comes to our current political leaders. We'll look at Elizabeth Warren on her foreign policy that no one is discussing and why that is so problematic. So, and by the way, Sam is an American journalist. He's a political activist who serves as the communications director of the Institute for Public Accuracy, which is a nonprofit that promotes progressive experts as alternatives to mainstream media. He really worked with FAIR and the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. He is also the founder of VotePAC, which brings voters from both parties together to agree on progressive causes. He writes for Counterpunch, The Nation, Salon, and other news outlets. And his website is Husseini, H-U-S-S-E-I-N-I, Post, P-O-S-T, Haven, H-A-V-E-N.com. We'll go to him in the second part. It's an important topic. But we always begin with the latest on health and healing. This is in the University of California at San Diego, published in Peer Review Journal PLOS ONE. And it talks about how when you have higher, let's say a higher risk of leukemia is directly correlated to a lower input of sunlight and vitamin D. So this is significant because you would think in California people would be getting a lot of sunlight unless they use a lot of suntan lotion, in which case it blocks the ultraviolet exposure, which helps create the vitamin D in our skin. And that means you're more likely to have a vitamin D deficiency, and that means you're at a 200% greater risk of developing leukemia than people getting plenty of sunlight. It's just that simple. So that's why sunlight is so important. Also, from Northumbria University in the United Kingdom comes a study about oats and the steel-cut oats, and an extract can improve cognitive function and memory. It is called a wild green oat extract, and it's demonstrated cognitive function improvement in people, especially people in their 40s and 50s, who exhibited increased speed of performance and episodic memory in a clinical study. And the ingredient, again, I'll give it to you slowly. It's extracted from an ancient type wild oats. and it was developed by a group, and it's under the name Neuravena, N-E-U-R-A-V-N-E-N-A. And it's being called now a superfood because of what it can do to help our brains. And it's all natural, and that's important. Now, I believe that we could get something very similar if we just ate the unprocessed oats, the still-cut oats. When you cook them, you have to cook them at a low temperature, and they'll absorb the water. And they're a little gummy. They're like sticky. And it takes about 7 to 10 minutes, but it's far more nourishing for you, better fiber. Also, from the University of Florida comes a study published in the BBA Molecular and Cell Biology of Lipids, and it talks about linking stress and fat metabolism. And what it means in just lay language is if you're under constant stress, which many people are, and you can't lose weight, which some people can't, even though they try, there might be a protein to blame. In this particular experiment, the researchers have discovered that chronic stress stimulates production of what is known as betatrophin, B-E-T-A-T-R-O-P-H-I-N. Now, that's a protein that then goes on to inhibit an enzyme involved in fat metabolism. So, just keep in mind that the more stressed you are, the more likely you're going to have trouble losing weight because of this protein. So, therefore, stress management, deep breathing, prayer, meditation, relaxing walks, just petting a cat, a dog, giving them hugs, because there's unconditional love there, being in nature, all these are natural in their ability to reduce our stressors. It kind of brings us back into a more balanced state. And that's why instead of getting in someone's face and arguing and writing constant emails and leaving toxic messages on phones, just give that up. That's like smacking someone, and because they don't respond, you smack them again, and then they don't respond, you smack them again, and they don't respond the way you want, you smack them again. How many bad words said to someone, how many emotional, volatile, and toxic reactions do you think it's going to take before someone says, you're right? Never. We just are completely programmed to deal with stress and not getting our way, and not controlling other people the way we expect them to respond to us. And so we just keep doubling down. And then other people pick up this habit. And it's a bad habit. When you cannot deal with something, get into an environment where you can get perspective again, where you can get your emotional balance again, where you can go to neutral as best as you can, and then look at the problem and ask, if I want a solution for this problem, realistically, what is it? Then you're able to make a more realistic call. And otherwise, you're just tearing your body to pieces internally. From the Lancet, one more study on sugar. And this is an interesting one because they say if we reduced our sugar content in sugar-sweetened drinks by 40% over a five-year period, in just one country, that would save 1.5 million cases of obesity. That's the United Kingdom. And 300 cases of diabetes. Well, when you consider the population of Great Britain compared to the United States, we're talking about millions of people's lives can be improved or saved, because when you're obese or you're diabetic, you have a far higher incidence of dying. So, something to consider, get rid of the sugar. From a university in Japan, Tohoku, they can now say that the isoflavones found in soybeans helps insomniacs get some sleep. They studied more than 1,000 participants from various walks of life. And knowing that we are sleep-deprived worldwide and looking for natural alternatives, the university researchers found that an isoflavone found in soybeans has a positive benefit for sleep seekers. And that's because the chemical structure of isoflavone comprises a class of phytoestrogens resembling human estrogen, which modulates sleep during and quality in some populations and with weak estrogenic effects. So the higher intake of isoflavones was positively associated with optimal sleep during and quality in the Japanese population. And that was published in the peer-reviewed Nutrition Journal. Also, from the University of British Columbia, a study about valuing your time more than money is linked to happiness. And what it says, in effect, is that when you can stop for a moment and ask yourself, how much do you sacrifice for the opportunities that you bring into your life? What does it actually cost you? And we almost never think about how much time we spend when we contribute to something or do something. So valuing your time more than the pursuit of money is linked to greater happiness. And there were 6 separate studies with over 4,600 participants that found that this was the case. This was published in Social, Psychological, and Personality Science. And I remember once when I was just at the beginning of my career, and my agent, Bob Smith, who had formerly been the head of RKO Radio and Television, and he'd retired, then he unretired shortly thereafter, months after that, because he was bored, and he had heard me on a radio program and said, you should have a larger audience and because you're not one of these slick radio broadcasters, you know, you just sound like a guy from a small town, or you're bringing some common sense, and we need something. And I remember he said, have you ever heard of Will Rogers? I said, yes. He said, well, you kind of remind me of what a young Will Rogers would be doing if he had a radio program. So he's the one who got me my first program on WMCA. I'd been on another program, Balkan Echo Studios, out of New York for 5 years before that. In any case, one day he says, I've got a meeting. And we had a meeting. I never met these people. And there were 9 people at a dinner at a restaurant. And they had mentioned that a very famous household nutritionist name was going to retire and had been associated with their company, and they wanted me to be the new young person because there was no one young in the world of health and nutrition. I mean, the youngest were in their 60s, and most were in their 70s, and some were in their 80s. Dr. Christopher, John Christopher, he was in his 80s. Paul Bragg, Linda Clark, Catherine Elwood, Carlton Fredericks, Gaylord Houser, Adele Davis. No one young. Not a single person. In any case, they made the offer, and the offer was that I'd get a very nice commission if I would be out there promoting their product, and I could contribute to my to their design of products, etc. And I asked them a simple question. How many days of my time each year would this require? And they said, well, we'd have to have you on tour. Remember, there's no internet. You had to go out on tours and meet with people, lots of people. And I said, well, I can give you my answer now. And they said, what is it? I said, I'm going to have to pass on this. Why? Well, because I'm raising my daughter, and that's my priority. No matter how much money I would be making, and I'm assuming I'd be making a lot of money, and I believe in supporting philanthropic causes so that money could be applied, not to me. I don't, you know, I have very simple needs. I lived in a small $57 a month apartment on West 89th Street, in one room. So it wasn't materialism I was interested in. It was helping the other causes that were important to me. I said, but there's no cause more important than making sure that this life, this that I brought into this world with her mother, that this life is given a chance to understand the real world and how to relate to people of all races and all backgrounds and how to evolve until she's able to do it all on her own. And then they emphasized the money again, and I said, you don't understand. I'm not motivated by money. It's nice to have if you know how to use it to help others, but just to have more money, I don't see the point. And so after the meeting, which did not end well, they were not that cordial. They didn't expect this to happen, and Bob Smith didn't expect it to happen either, but it did. And so from my own personal perspective, there have been three times in my career where I said no because of, well, different considerations, but time was a very important factor. And when I was asked to do a radio show, a television show, morning television, I said no. And that ended my relationship with a very important agent in the United States, a household name agent, because he said, if you're not going to take my advice and open these doors, I said, it's not about opening doors. That is certainly appreciated, because what most people don't understand is 95% or higher of success in life comes when someone offers you an opportunity, whether you're a ballerina and you get an audition, or a Broadway play, or a writer. Everyone, we have to have someone who introduces us. And if we don't ever have anyone help us open a door, see how difficult it is to open it strictly on your own. And then you realize how many people who have, some have great talent, others have marginal talent, some have no talent. Have you noticed how few people in the performing arts, at least in Hollywood today, honor the gifts they've been given by continuing each day to go to class and master their skills and the range of their capacity to become a part of a character? Christian Bale is a good example of one who does. And some of the older people like Meryl Streep does. And the last school of people to do this as a group, Harvey Keitel, Al Pacino, Robert De Niro, Christopher Walken, John Hurt. These individuals either went to HB Studio, Uta Hagen, Stanley Meiser, the great teachers. But they were going like you would go to class to become a doctor. They had to learn things because they had to be convincing. Real acting is when you realize someone is not acting. When you see someone and you can't tell they're acting. It is so real and believable. Well, that means they had to commit themselves. That means they had to value that. Today, I went to see Cat on a Hot Tin Roof not long ago, and Scarlett Johansson was in it, and she went in and out of character, in and out of Southern accent about every 2 minutes. And yet people liked it because they were there for the celebrity connection, not the quality of her acting, which is non-existent. But today, you don't have to be an actor to act. You simply have to be a celebrity. You're packaged as a celebrity. You're rewarded for that. Nobody cares if you've never taken a class and don't care about what you're doing. You only care about all the rewards you get, all the acknowledgement, your celebrity status, your picture everywhere. Yeah, that's what we become. So just imagine then, when you're given an opportunity, and you'll get all that, but your time is no longer yours, you have to give that. That's the exchange. And then you think of how you lose balance in life when you no longer have time to maintain balance. Did I read that book? No, I'll get to it. Did I? No, I'll get to it. Did I call my? No, you'll get to it. And then you have a long list as I'm going to get to it, and you don't. Because we get connected to the benefit, whatever it may be, of what's coming our way. So when they say that judging the quality of your life by what you say no to, and saying no to opportunity that deprives you of having balance in your life, and quality time for family and friends, and relationships, that's essential. And I remember the guy, he actually showed up on the set when I was on PBS New York with How to Live Forever. And at that time, it was the most successful special in PBS history. And there he is. I'm in the green room in between the pitching when they're playing the program. And he's motivating me to be a part of this new group. And there were many meetings. I finally said no. I won't go into the reasons why. But he said, you realize you're giving away $1 billion. And I said, what does it matter? My time, if I don't have a penny in my pocket, is worth more to me than having money and no life. And he said, well, if you don't take it, Atkins will. I said, Atkins, let him. And he did. And he did make the money. But how much time did he have? Quality of life did he have? What do we sacrifice for our success? I think we should do courses in school about how not to become imbalanced by success. And success is really an illusion. Success is only getting other people to convince other people that they should give you their money and time and praise. But it becomes addictive. You have to keep getting it. Think of the Lady Gagas and the Madonnas and all the other people who have to exaggerate whatever talent they do have so we pay attention to them. Think of the people who thrive only when someone is acknowledging them. Wow. Now look at our state of depression and loneliness in our country. It is epidemic. So we are angry and emotionally concerned about what we don't have, because we have had so many of these prancing peacocks living in our lives every day, showing us that we don't have enough, and we shouldn't like what we have, and don't we have the newest gadget, and let's all line up and on a Black Friday, and let's all indebt ourselves to get something that we're absolutely sure is going to make us feel happier, and it doesn't. When was the last time something you did gave you that happiness that you possessed? Anyhow, that's what that study shows. Good for them. And finally, from Drexel University, they have an article about harnessing the body's immune system to heal wounds naturally. In what could be a pivotal step towards repairing non-healing wounds and damaged organs, a Drexel University biomedical engineer has identified an immune cell as a potential strategy for growing blood vessels. Dr. Kara Spiler, assistant professor in the School of Biomedical Engineering and Science, is looking into this area and believes that damaged tissue due to cancer, a bone fracture, or a disease like diabetes happens because insufficient blood vessels grow, growth has cut off oxygen. So if we can figure out how to get new blood vessels growing, and that's what the research is doing, and that's spawning a whole new avenue into blood vessel growth by taking advantage of the body's response to injury and disease. And as a result, these immune cells called macrophages are part of the process. And macrophages roam throughout all tissues in the body and engulf any pathogens in their path. And though these immune cells destroy foreign invaders, they have earned a bad reputation because they also contribute to the body's inflammatory response, causing bruises and ulcers and sometimes degenerative diseases. However, more recent studies have shown that macrophages and inflammation, more generally, can play an important role in tissue repair and regeneration due to the cell's ability to change their form, phenotype, it's known as, and function, each orchestrating events specific to different stages of repair. So that's what's being done. So in the near future, I'm pretty sure I'll be telling you that they have made some major progress in that area. That's the latest on health and healing, and now we're going to go into our studio in New York, and I'm going to ask Jesse to play some of the people. I don't know who you got up there, Jesse, but let's just hear who they are and what questions they have, and I'll address them.
This question is for Gary. Hi, Gary. This is Karen from New York, and I want to ask you if you think that a place such as Peekskill is all right to live in. It is near Indian Point, and they will be closing Indian Point. And my question is, do you think it still would be a contaminated area to live in? Thank you so much for your help.
Okay, the answer is no. I would not consider that a good area to live in. First of all, it isn't closing right now. I've been part of an effort with Dr. Carl Grossman, Harvey Wasserman, and a large coalition of individuals, including the River Project, to help close Indian Point. Many of you, thousands of you, came to a demonstration outside of the governor's office, the largest demonstration, I was told by the police lieutenant, in New York history in front of the governor's office. And then we demonstrated later up at Indian Point about closing it. And what we did is all of us together, it was a joint effort, we all made presentations about why it must be closed and what lies we've been told about the safety and naturalness of nuclear power. It's not. And here are some of the reasons why I would not live near one. First of all, there's someone in this audience, may even be listening now, who lives 8 miles from Indian Point. And there is an epidemic of cancer, especially breast cancer and other cancers, in women who have no obvious risk factors, meaning they're not smokers or drinkers, because they're getting ionizing radiation from Indian Point. Also, there is a woman named Merrill. It's her family's Merrill Lynch. And she contacted me, and she was on a crusade to try to close Indian Point. And she was going house to house in every neighborhood in the communities closest to Indian Point, and found that there was a very high incidence of breast cancer. So even if you closed Indian Point, the decontamination process will take decades. Also, it's not just the core that you have to be concerned with and the 2 billion gallons of water that's taken out of the river, the Hudson River in this case, to cool down the turbines that have to be done every 24 hours. But it's also the fact that the outside spent fuel rods, and you have 300 to 500% more spent fuel rods outside in these pools than you have inside the plant itself. And those are extremely toxic. Now, the fact that they use the word spent fuel rods doesn't mean that there's no radiation. There's a huge amount of radiation in those. And that's one of the problems with Fukushima. The core melted right through the floor and went into the subterranean areas, including aquifers, that then that water in the aquifer feeds their rice areas in Japan. But it's the number of the cores that are hanging as spent fuel rods in one of the adjacent buildings. And if that were to tumble because of another earthquake or tsunami, that would cause a humongous natural disaster, the worst in history, worse than Chernobyl. So it's never going to be safe. That's the simple, not in your lifetime, not in the next 20 people's lifetimes. Now, you should always look at a place and then draw a map 100 miles around a nuclear power plant and ask, are you in the downwind or the upwind? Because if you're in the downwind, then if you were 100 miles or 500 miles, you're going to get irradiation, even in small amounts. If you're north of that, then it's safer. And I would try to be as far away from a nuclear power plant as possible. Okay? Now, that has nothing to do with the quality of life or people or aesthetics or the things people normally look for when they're wanting a home in a more rural environment or a country environment or a mountainous environment. And New York has some beautiful places to live, but you'd have to go up and outside of the nuclear area and outside of the gas hydrofracking area. And that's what you should ask. And there are maps that can show you how many gas hydrofracking sites are there, how many nuclear, and then you can do your research in that. Then you find out about your water and the quality of your soil and the taxes and the zoning and whether there is a population living there that's in where the whole economy is declined. And that brings me to another issue. What America needs now is to be honest about why we have so many people in inner cities that are challenged and struggling. And we've had two groups. One says that because we haven't provided these people with the essential services, better quality schools and parks and medical care and psychological counseling. And another group, says, no, we've done all that, and we've done more than that than we have in any other part of our society, and it's because they're single parents. Those are common two reasons. But the reality is completely different. Those both have an impact, absolutely, because it's always better to have two loving parents who are conscious and understand what it is to be a parent and not a best friend. You should never be the best friend of your daughter or son. You should be a loving, but a parent who understands the consequences when there is no understanding of life and cause and effect or discipline. But the real underlying reason that we have seen ourselves fall from where we were in the 70s is because starting in the 70s, there was a silent revolution. You have made heard of green mail, where people would buy a certain percentage of stock to get into a company, and then they would, in effect, green mail or blackmail the company, buy us out and give us a nice bonus to leave, and we won't cause you any more problems. And people felt it was just the cost of doing business, and they would buy these people out. And then from that, you had the corporate raiders. But then the corporate raider, that sounds negative. Sounds like a mugger. So they changed it to equity partners. Oh, that sounds nice. Equity sounds good. And a partner in doing equity. Well, equity is an asset. And these people began to buy companies that had employed thousands of people in different communities, including in Newark, Camden, New Jersey, Detroit, all the cities that in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, and beginning of 70s were all booming. They had little to no unemployment. They were thriving. They had a strong middle class. There was no debt. And we didn't have the crime at the level we have now. And then the jobs began to be taken out of the United States because the partners found that when they bought a company, what they were really buying was the reputation and the marketability of the monikered slogan. So if you bought a Campbell Soup, or if you bought a Circuit City, if you bought whatever the name was, that's what really had the asset value. So why make something in the United States where we had 50% more or less, some say 49, some say 51, but let's just say 50% of American workers were union. That means they had union bargaining. That means that they had maternity leave and you were paid extra for overtime and all the other things that helped create a strong, viable middle class that had more money in their pocket. And at one point, a dollar bill would exchange hands up to 67 times in a community. You get paid, from the factory, then you got to get a haircut. And the barber goes to see a movie. And the person at the movie goes to eat in a restaurant. The person in the restaurant goes to a local, you know, hair salon. The person in the hair salon goes to buy a new jacket. It's circulated. Today, it doesn't happen. It's been done by credit cards. And as a result, they took the brands, because that's what they're buying really is a brand, and they said, let's make a deal with other countries. Well, China wasn't the country originally that was open to us. It was still under Mao, and there were lots of problems with tariffs. But they went to India and Haiti. Most of our baseballs and softballs were made in Haiti. And we could exploit these people, because if you made a dress in Bangladesh, it cost about 14 cents an hour. If you made that same identical dress with the same materials, the same style, down in New York and on 32nd Street, and the International Ladies Garment Workers Union employee was making it, it was upwards of $30 an hour. Now, I know this because I used to be the nutritionist for that whole group. I would do cooking classes, nutrition classes, and I helped so many of these people lose weight and overcome conditions. So you get to know a lot about an industry when you're working with them on a weekly basis, and I did. So why in the world then, these people thought, why should we be making dresses here when we can make them for 14 cents an hour? Now, none of these equity partners had to go to Bangladesh to see the conditions. And here was a woman who had the shortest lifespan in the workforce in the world, about 32 years of age. She would be expected to work a minimum of 14 hours a day and sometimes up to 16 hours a day. She would have a man walk up and down the aisles as she was sewing on pockets or zippers. And she could be timed. And if she didn't do it right, he would have a switch and he would hit her with the switch. She was allowed to go to the bathroom twice, and the water in the place was toxic. And then after she was exhausted from work, she would walk home. She couldn't afford public transportation or private transportation. And when she finally got home, her family would be asleep, and she would have to make their food for the next day, do their laundry for the next day, make herself some food, get a few hours sleep, and get back up the next morning. Also, 800 million garments last year were sold from Bangladesh alone, so people could make profits. So the person buying it didn't care about the ethics. Most didn't. The person creating this didn't care. And now brands that had been made downtown were no longer being made downtown. Imprinting of books, same way. And almost all of our industries were then seeing that it was much more profitable to be shipped overseas. Now, when you take a community that has been fully employed and has a strong working middle class, Camden, New Jersey, that has no crime, so to speak, and is a side-by-side city with Philadelphia, and people had lived there for generations in prosperity, and now their jobs are gone. There's no training for any new job. There is unemployment, there is depression, anxiety, and then the disintegration of families, and then we end up with what we have today. So you see, then explain to me again, because I want to hear your perspective, how you think it's just because of not having, you know, having a single parent instead of two as the only reason. So you see, there's a bedrock underneath. Everything has gone wrong in America when it comes to causing 96 million Americans, or 22% of our workforce, to be out of work, though we lie and say it's only 3.8%, because we can't handle the truth. And that's how we got ourselves into this mess that we're in today. Anyhow, we're going to go to our guest in a second, but I'll take another call there. Go ahead, please.
Yes, can you please speak on the radio, Gary Noel, about cataracts, how to get rid of them, even if they're advanced cataracts?
Okay, well, there are several options. And today, one of the most practical options is surgery, if you can afford it. It's not that expensive. There are things you can do to help mitigate them and prevent them, and some things you can do to help lessen them. But the cataract surgeries have a very high level of success, and then you never have cataracts again, and it's a relatively quick and simple operation done properly. And that is one thing I would definitely consider. But also, a cataract is a clouding of the eye's lens that can cause you all forms of problems. It's like looking at something when someone just put a cloth over your eyes, and the cloth is very thin to begin, and then over years it gets progressively thicker until you really lose your farsight. You can't see very far, and you have to look at everything up close. And in some causes of cataracts, and most almost all the underlying major causes are oxidative stress. That's why smokers had so much oxidative stress from the cigarette smoke, and drinkers from the alcohol, causing a vascular constriction, meaning not enough blood getting into the microcapillary system of the brain, the feet. All you have to do is look at someone's feet, and around the ankles you see purple and blue and spider veins, almost always poor circulation. Well, if you have poor circulation in one area, generally you have it in all areas. Also, diabetes can cause it. Heavy metal poisoning, high mercury levels can cause it. Exposure to radiation and certain drugs like steroids. Ask bodybuilders, ask athletes who've used steroids, anabolic steroids, how's their vision? Almost always you'll see it's a problem. And it's a gradual, painless loss of vision. And it also can lead to blindness in time. So what would I do to start? Well, first and foremost, I would detoxify a person. I would put them on a cleansing diet, a raw food diet for at least a month, and I would see that they get copper, generally 2 to 3 milligrams a day. That's very important for healing and for retarding the growth of cataracts. Manganese, anise, is 5 to 10 milligrams a day. Also glutathione. Gluta, G-L-U-T-A, thione, T-H-I-O-N-E, and that's an amino acid that is a potent antioxidant, aids in the maintaining a healthy lens in the eye and protects against toxins. I would use grapeseed extract, L-lysine, pantothenic acid, which is vitamin B5 at about 500 milligrams, selenium, an important free radical destroyer, scavenger, and vitamin A is really good for visual function. Generally is a 25,000 or more of the vitamin A is carotenoid complex. A B complex at 50 milligrams. And vitamin C I would do more, generally 3,000 milligrams twice a day. Vitamin E, 400 units. These are all important, but also so are the herbs. And people don't realize that bilberry extract is important for the eyes, and taken orally, and also the bioflavonoids aid in removing toxic chemicals from the retina of the eye, and also ginkgo biloba improves microcapillary circulation, and lots of green vegetable juices. I would include collard greens, kale, mustard greens, spinach, turnip greens, a lot of the berries. I would have a lot of berry concentrate or berries like blackberries, cherries, and I would avoid all the saturated fats except coconut oil, all dairy, all animal fats, no wheat, no fried food, and drink a lot of healthy water. And that's what you could do. Also, you have to avoid antihistamines if you have cataracts. So those are some of the natural things you can do. Zeaxanthin from broccoli and collard greens and mustard greens and spinach and turnip greens are also much better for the cataracts. And vitamin C is probably your best single nutrient. Okay, that's it on that, because we got to go to our guest now who's standing by. Let's go over now and say hello to my guest. And I gave you his bio earlier on in the program, so I believe he is standing by right now. Let me just check my computer and say, Sam, are you there?
I am there. Thank you, Gary.
Thank you for being with us today. I gave the bio to you and your website earlier on in the program.
Great.
Sam, I'm going to give you one overarching question, and just take your time and no rushing it in. Here's my concern. As a person who once supported liberal causes and now I support non-corporate liberal or conservative causes that help humans, the environment, without identifying in the politics of it. Yet most people going to Washington have monikered themselves either conservative or liberal, and then some really point to their credentials, like Elizabeth Warren. Why should she be president? And I'm thinking, well, how about you signing a letter with every single member of Congress saying that you support Israel no matter what it does? And I'm thinking, what do you mean, whatever it does? Well, what if it violated international treaty and invaded Iran? And what has it done to the Palestinian people? Does that not warrant you being concerned? And not a word of this is ever mentioned in the media in Washington, from the Washington Post or CNN. So no one questions people where they know they are weak, and they all get behind something that we could all generally say is good, like universal health care. So would you take us through, please, what you see are the differences between the corporate Democrats, like the Hillary Clinton crowd that controls much of Washington's body politic, and the newer, more idealistic social Democrats that are getting in there, and what we're likely to see as the challenges for both groups? And also give us a couple people you'd like us to know more about based upon what they're supporting. The forum is yours.
Thanks. I'm not sure if I can quite address the last part of your question, but let me go to what I think is the meat of your question. And I think that the general dynamics of what we've seen in the U.S. political system, and perhaps increasingly so, is you have corporate Democrats, which, as you say, embodied by the Clintons. But we also saw this around Obama, and we also see this on the other side. Republicans who pose as compassionate conservatives and such, and end up pursuing and backing a lot of the same corporate interests. So whether you have Clinton or Obama or the Bushes or Trump, you have Goldman Sachs basically in charge of Treasury Department. Whether you have any of those individuals, you basically have a continuation in different ways, perhaps, but basic structure of American empire and war making. And at a certain level, I think that there's a con going on. That is, and it's perpetuated by the media system, where a lot of people watch MSNBC and get all riled up about Donald Trump, and therefore back not just Democrats lately. It's gotten worse. Now they'll back, you know, establishment Republicans, and the Bushes have been rehabilitated in spite of the extraordinary criminality of their invasions and bombings and so on of Iraq. And then on the other side, you know, it's both MSNBC and Fox are basically the arms of each of the political parties that keep the public that's still engaged in the political process confined. And you got to vote for either Democrat or Republican because you so loathe the other side. It's taken on a somewhat new dynamic with Trump. Ali Abunima, I believe, coined the term Trump washing. That is, so much of the political establishment has cleansed themselves of their behavior and criminal activity because Trump is so obviously bad, and therefore I'm okay no matter what I've done. And so you have people who, in both parties, who rely on this. And I think to a certain extent, Elizabeth Warren, although I think she has some good ideas and some insights in terms of economy, domestic economy, is particularly clear if you parse what she says in terms of foreign policy, that she's not, either because she she doesn't want to, or a lack of courage, or whatever the reason is, not going to break with that system. And, you know, Sanders, for example, gives somewhat conflicting evidence. I think that there's more evidence of him breaking with the system to a larger degree on both economy and particularly increasingly foreign policy. I criticized Sanders in 2015 during the campaign for his not just his silence on a lot of foreign policy issues. My colleague Norman Solomon wrote a strong piece at the time criticizing his silence, and then I wrote a piece criticizing what little foreign policy we had heard from him was the Saudis have to get their hands dirty and, you know, really start pulling their weight in the Middle East. And I'm like, the Saudis were bombing the hell out of Yemen, inflicting enormous suffering. Their hands are plenty dirty as it is. And since that time, he's become one of the most vocal critics of Saudi Arabia, attempting most recently to assert power of Congress in terms of war-making authority. And there may be some problems with his bill. The ACLU has criticized it for solidifying the AUMF, the original authorization for military force, which is still sitting there from 2001. And they worry that his legislation may solidify that rather than revoke it, which is what should happen. We should not be in a perpetual war situation. And that's the kind of thing that you don't hear really any politician saying. I can't think of anybody, with the possible exception of Ron Paul or Dennis Kucinich, who might say we have to end our perpetual war position altogether. I think that there have been some good statements from some of the younger Democrats who have just come in to the House, and I can see some cause for optimism there. But I don't. I'm concerned that they are not steeped enough in what exactly it is they're up against. And I think we have to be clear what we're up against. It's a perpetual war machine, and on the economic sector, not just Wall Street, but general corporate America, as you indicate, in particular, the high-tech sector has become central, has superseded Wall Street in many ways as the core of the establishment economy, because it not only is incredibly profitable, but it also has incredible power of surveillance and collusion with big government and so on. So I think that there's an imperative. I mean, I certainly consider myself somebody from the left still. But I feel that I've come to the assessment that that partisanship, that boxing people in, is part of the mechanism to and the adjacent lesser evilism is part of the method that the establishment uses against both liberals and, in somewhat different ways, but still substantially, towards so-called conservatives, to forestall meaningful change. Obama got in promising hope and change. He continued war-making continued corporate economic policies. Some things on the edges. Had a modest stimulus package, for example. Did Dodd-Frank, did Obamacare, but that was something that the big healthcare companies wanted, the so-called healthcare companies, the big insurance companies particularly, and the big hospitals and so on wanted that. And you see that on the other side where, you know, Trump, there's certainly a nativist appeal and a racist appeal and a level of misogyny, but there is a, you know, I mean, I've heard Trump say critical things of U.S. foreign policy that I've never heard any other major figure say. I mean, in terms of people who've gotten close to the presidency. He says something like, you know, I think I can deal with Putin, and Bill O'Reilly tells him, but Putin kills people, and what does Trump say? We kill people. You know, he talks about the trillion spent on the Iraq war and so on, where we should have been building at home. I think it's totally disingenuous coming from Trump, but I also think that there's a high level of disingenuousness coming from people who posed or people thought that they were taking a position that was anti-war. So I think we have to scrutinize both so-called sides and ultimately try to grapple with some form of political realignment that does foster meaningful change and is largely based on hearing the other side in a very grassroots way so that you have people from the grassroots asserting themselves against the establishment across the political spectrum.
I appreciate those insights, Sam. Thank you very much for coming on and letting us have an awareness that we can't just rely upon everyone going to Washington to be interested in what we need, our cities, our children, our seniors, our sick. They need help. Right now, they're not getting what they deserve. So hopefully some of the newer ones, more idealistic ones that are in the House, will start raising questions that otherwise the careerist never seem to raise.
Hopefully. I certainly think that there is something of a schism there. But I also, you know, comprehend that there's a very steep hill to climb and that we shouldn't be fueled by, we need adrenaline, but we can't necessarily be fueled by it. We have to be, you know, we have to feed off of understanding and knowing the power of the system and where exactly and what the exact power is of a few individuals, and to the extent that they are going to utilize their positions in Congress to at least ask questions, that's all well and good. But it's, you know, I mean, we clearly, as we saw last night, have Pelosi and Schumer firmly in control. And there might be minor differences between Pelosi and Schumer, but they are very firmly creatures of Wall Street and of corporate America and of perpetual war. Even, you know, if they rhetorically, I mean, Pelosi, you know, so much of the establishment is expert at taking a position rhetorically, but not actually pursuing it. Pelosi technically voted against the Iraq war, but she actually facilitated it happening and forestalled many possibilities of attempting to stop the Iraq war. That's certainly true of Biden, for example, who was head of the Foreign Relations Committee in the Senate during the buildup of the Iraq war, although he actually voted for it, and in various ways to of Schumer, who also voted for the Iraq war. So I think that we need mechanisms both in terms of the media that we build, in terms of, I mean, it's really the job of the media, independent media, to ask questions. I've been trying to get into the State Department, for example, and ask tough questions there. It's very difficult. But, you know, that's, you know, that's a role that others can fulfill besides new Congress people. New Congress people should be in a position of utilizing those things to actually enact legislation for meaningful change.
Sam, thank you very much for being with us today. My guest, Sam Husseini. I'm Gary Null. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening, and have a nice day.